WML. Joining us right now, Alan Dershowitz, Harvard Law Professor, author of a brand new book. Boy, get this one. I need to now be very deliberate when I pronounce this so everyone understands what I'm saying. Alan Dershowitz's book is called Electile Dysfunction, A Guide for Unaroused Voters. Well, Mr. Dershowitz, it's the blue pill of books.
Well, you know, when you get to be my age, I just turned 78, it gets harder to be aroused by candidates. I'm used to better candidates.
Well, let's.
I wrote the book.
Let's talk about these candidates and specifically about the topics that were raised last night in the debate. My biggest problem with the debate last night, I think, had to do with what we were talking about. What's the point if you win a debate when you're talking about topics people don't care about? And according to a Pew poll, Professor Dershowitz, the number two and number three most important topics to people are terrorism and foreign policy. There was no discussion about our relationship with Israel, probably the most important foreign policy relationship we have, and barely any discussion about what's going on in the Middle East with regard to terrorism. What was
right.
your take?
I had the same conclusion, and indeed there's such an important issue going on with Israel now. President Obama is essentially threatening to tie the hands of the next president and make it impossible for there to be a reasonable, peaceful resolution by not vetoing the absurd French resolution that's coming before the Security Council that would basically compel Israel to recognize the Palestinian state without the Palestinians doing anything in return without any compromises. If Obama allows that to go through, it's going to make it harder for whoever is the next president, whether it be, you know, Clinton or Trump, to reasonably resolve it. And he's going to be tying their hands during his lame duck period. And I hope in the next debate, they're going to ask both candidates, should the president do that during his lame duck period of 2 months? Also on the issue of terrorism, Americans care deeply about terrorism, and there was just no reasonable, you know, the arguments were very technical about trade. Most Americans don't have any idea what a trade bill is or how it impacts on jobs directly, and you had two people each saying their plan would produce better jobs. How is an average person able to assess what's better for his family, her family, America in general? So I think the debate was a failure in terms of communication of important issues to the average voter. It was a success in terms of seeing who was a little cooler under pressure, who was the one who was able to provoke the other. I think that she did come off as somewhat more presidential, and he came off as somewhat more easily provoked.
I want to ask you about the premise of your book, because I think it's very interesting. Why are voters not excited about the election? And I've been taken by something I saw sometime back in the New York Times. It was a graphic which explained that really, in the final assessment, when you really look and count all the numbers, there are 324 million people in America. And at the end of the day, about 4.5% of all of the American public voted for Trump in the primary, and about 4.5% of the American public voted for Hillary Clinton in the primary, and that, you know, total about 9% of the population was enthusiastic about these two candidates, and yet they become the nominees of their parties, respectively. And it, doesn't that explain a lot why our system is set up in a way that a very excited few people can bring a nominee that the rest of the nation is not very excited about?
No, I think that's absolutely right. And believe me, there's nothing new about that. When Jefferson ended up beating Adams and then Burr in the famous 1800 election, which is the subject of the great musical Hamilton, something like 100,000 people voted out of 10,000 Americans. In the 1824 election, it was something like 300,000 people out. It was amazing how few people voted because, of course, in those days, we didn't let people vote unless they had property. They were white, they were male, you name it. Today, everybody can vote if you're over 18, and yet so few people actually participate actively in the political process, and that's a shame. And I think we're going to see this election may be determined by default, because a lot of Americans won't vote, particularly young ones, who then complain louder than anybody else, or they'll throw away their vote by voting for a third-party candidate, or, you know, they'll just vote, but they'll vote not for a candidate, but against the candidate. And that's democracy by default, and it really shows the lack of functioning of our system in the best sense of the word. First, we ought to have compulsory voting. everybody who is eligible to vote or to have to vote or make a good reason for not doing it. I mean, you can write a little essay saying I don't like either candidate, but not voting by default. Look what happened in Brexit. Brexit, one of the most important votes in British history. Young people complained bitterly about the outcome, and yet they stayed home because it was a rainy day. I mean, that's not democracy working.
Well, or it is. I don't know. I mean, if people have higher priorities, doesn't that say, I don't know if I want their vote if they take it that unseriously.
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, do you really want 25% of the public to be able to elect, 4.5%, 9% of the public to be able to nominate? That's a very, very serious issue. And it also emphasizes the role of money, because if very few people to participate and a small number of people contribute the vast majority of money to the campaigns, and, you know, the media run this campaign for months and months and months and months, and most European and other countries, campaigns for the leader of the country are a 2 or 3 month proposition. Here they're a 2 or 3 year proposition. And I think that also dissipates interest in the actual event, which is anticlimactic in some ways.
I agree. Our guest is Alan Dershowitz, and we would be remiss if we didn't draw on your vast constitutional expertise in helping us out with an issue that happened last night. There was a question of constitutional law with regard to stop and frisk in New York. Listen to this really quickly.
Crime.
Your 2 minutes has expired, but I do want to follow up. Stop and frisk was ruled unconstitutional in New York because it largely singled out Black and Hispanic young men.
No, you're wrong.
Now, not getting into the merits of whether stop and frisk is a constitutional policy, was Lester Holt correct there in saying that it was ruled unconstitutional? Because doesn't it have to go to a much higher court for there to be a definitive ruling like that?
Well, there was a district court judge, Shira Scheinlin, who ruled that the New York stop and frisk, as applied, was unconstitutional. She wrote a 100-and-some-odd page opinion. But it didn't get to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's last word on it was a case called Terry versus Ohio many, 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 many years ago. And the Supreme Court held, under certain circumstances at least, stop and frisk can be constitutional. Look, the interesting thing is how it's applied. In Massachusetts, it was applied in a very effective way with the cooperation of some of the leaders of the African-American community. And it really helped to disarm gang members in parts of the city where the crime rate was very high. But if it's used just as a form of racial profiling, then it's done in a way that probably raises constitutional questions. But it's much more subtle and much more complex and a hard issue to raise in the context of a two-minute answer to a debate.
Probably would have been best for Lester Holt to not even wade into quote-unquote fact-checking on that.
I think you don't fact-check in your question. Fact-check after the answer is given. And I think he made a controversial statement, which then Donald Trump responded to factually, and they both had some truth on their side.
Great. Alan Dershowitz, got to leave it there. But again, the book, Electile Dysfunction, A Guide for Unaroused Voters. Well done there, just in the title. Alan Dershowitz, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
We always love having you.
Thanks
for coming back on.